Welcome to the NTNU International Taiwan Studies Center podcast. I'm the host, Josh, and today I'm actually connecting with home in some ways. It's a real pleasure to be online with the UK and welcoming a good friend, actually, Tihan, who is a senior teaching fellow at SOAS now, formerly at the University of Central Lancashire. Tihan, what a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Joshua. That is really a pleasure to see you. Hoping to see you back in the UK or vice versa when I go back to Taiwan.
Tihan, perhaps the best place to start right now is I feel like in the last 2 months, you've had three books that have all been published. It's almost like we talk about British buses, that you wait for them for a long time and then three come at once. But perhaps you could just mention the books, because you've had this one, Reorientating Taiwan, Ocean, Selfhood and the Pacific.
Yes.
And you've also got A Taiwanese Eco-Critical Reader, mm-hmm. and Isle of the Austronesian, Indigeneity, Worldmaking and Taiwan. And all three of them were released, is it between July and September now, where we are?
Not exactly, because the Isle of Austronesian came out, and also it coincided with Reorientating Taiwan about mid-August, at the end of August this year. And the Eco Literary Reader officially will be released at the end of this year, actually, with the one that we were talking about, the translation anthology on eco literature, edited, led by Ian Rowan. Professor Ian Rowan used to be in Shida, and then also with Professor Daryl Sturck in Hong Kong.
Okay. So, well, I mean, it's still quite a feat to have that many books. Today, I think we're going to focus on the book Reorientating Taiwan, Ocean, Selfhood and the Pacific. But just before we dive into that particular book, do you want to give just a little background on yourself and your favorite areas of research interest?
Of course, of course. That would be great. Well, the bus metaphor is really awesome. It's somehow, in a way also, I can't take three bus all at once. So today, what I agree with you, Josh, is we're going to talk about Reorientating Taiwan. But it is true, like it was an exciting moment to building up with different books coming out. Mainly two of them were translated literary works, but the other one that today we're talking about, Reorientating Taiwan, this one is with Professor Nikki Elsfer, my former colleague and my dear boss. That one is more academic publication. And I would say the three of them overlap with all some of my research interests anyway. And one thing that was exciting is I have been always working on eco-literature since my PhD, half on Taiwan author and half on South African author. And then from the moment when I started at UCLan, the last 7 years about, we're working mainly focusing on Asia-Pacific and also Taiwan as the center of my research. And of course, eco-literature becoming a big part of my, how to say, academic identity. Can we say that?
Yeah.
And where it identifies me, but there are also other scholars who are very interesting, and then they always giving me new ideas. For example, Nikki, Ian, and also Xingqing, who we co-edited the Isle of Austronesian. They will come along and then said, would you like to do this and this project? And some of them related to indigeneity, but overlap with eco-literature. Some of them directly working on eco-literature, and also perhaps more talking about eco-philosophy, eco-ethics, or the literary different genres. And finally, with Nikki today, the Reorientating Taiwan, it was more pitching to an idea that Nikki used to have and saying about the framework of oceanic Taiwan, or viewing Taiwan in a different perspective from the ocean angle. Whereas I was working on the author of eco-literature, but he was also a ocean writer. So that was the sparkle of how we decided to come together. He from an anthropological historical position, and I'm more interested in literary or visual representations, or somehow like geopolitical sort of situation. Then that comes together. And so today we have this book, Reorientating Taiwan.
Yeah, you're bringing up that concept there of Taiwan as ocean, Taiwan as an oceanic country, an oceanic state. Do you think you could explain just maybe a little bit more about how you see this concept? I guess in one sense, the importance of it to the Taiwan studies field, and also how you see that beginning to influence and even change the field of Taiwan studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess different scholars will tell you sort of different narrative. Like Nikki has his take. The reason why we started it is because we're both co-teaching this Taiwan in the Asia Pacific module. And with his specialized area in Austronesian indigenous study, I'm not talking about for me just yet. Mm. I'm going to do a bit roundabout way. For him, it's more about the indigenous language that was carried out from an Austronesian sort of linguistic archaeology part of it, that Taiwan's unique gift alongside with Gerald Diamond, people like Peter Bellwood's kind of idea about dispersal of Austronesian culture that originates from Taiwan. My view, contrasting to Nikki, is more contemporary. Whereas I come from literary disciplines, when I was looking back on eco-literature that I really love about Taiwan, of course, I started with very famous author like Wu Mingyi. But eventually, not just Wu Mingyi, like the other authors I really like was Liao Hongji. And his writing, I remember reading him when I was in early 20s, and then you were amazed by how describe oceans. And then I was like, but I live in a city, sure. Like I live in Kaohsiung when I was young. I see the sea, but I never get this sort of experience about the mesmerized sort of ocean. It feels ocean is the idea that you go there, you play on the beach, you don't even get dirty, and that you feel like really, really hot, so that you don't enjoy the ocean that much as a Taiwanese person. And when I read his work, and because he's an author from the east coast of Taiwan, and he described about the Pacific Ocean, about the whales, and even the feelings that he sort of evoked, or from his point of view, tech. And I was like, this is amazing. And it's a writer who has no background of literary training. He graduated from high school and then eventually go to work and then become a fisherman writer from the start. And I was like, that part of nature can be so empowering for a single person. And then when I follow him a bit more and realizing what he's trying to do in recent year, this is something that very moving for me. And he said that if you come across any sort of tourism image and how Taiwan presents itself as a international kind of friendly image, when tourists come to Taiwan, what would they say? What would they want to see in Taiwan? And the first image you come across is the bear. And then he said that, but why? We are an island that is surrounded by these sort of oceanic field and also the cetacean beings inside. Why they can't represent Taiwan? This is my home. And then his way of finding home is actually relating to this more oceanic dynamics. I agree with him because even though me and the author has a different age gap, we grew up in different generations. But just until my generation, most of the people were still, because of the martial law, were still feeling rather afraid of the ocean, that kind of identity, even venturing out, taking the boat is something that is not very, very common for people in general. Yeah, so it is from there that I find that, interestingly, his writing made me feel there is a twist of Taiwan's narrative can be reappropriated. And of course, other different writers, like earlier I was saying that the very famous writer Wu Mingyi, who has been translated widely and even almost winning a Man Booker Prize, he was starting the most successful work for him, The Man with the Compound Eyes, was building on this idea of the ocean. And if we see his idea from this part of that island, the trash vortex and also the whales, it was also related to Xiamen Bonggan, another different writer from the Tao culture, and that they have this resonating oceanic image and identity within them.
Oh, that's fascinating. I think in your chapter, your kind of summary chapter of this book, you quote Liao Hongqi saying,
yes,
we must go round this island again and again. The more that we go round it, the larger it will become. I think that's a wonderful image. And then he goes on, as islanders, we should not be turning our backs to the sea, enjoying our seafood culture, yet forgetting our ocean roots. I guess the idea of ocean roots, that really fascinates me, because naturally, as people who live on land, when we talk about putting roots down, it's like you're staying in one place, whether it's your hometown, your home city, or maybe even the idea of buying a house or a flat. It's like rooting yourself on the land in one set place. And yet this idea of ocean roots feels much more transient and yet somehow just as much part of an identity.
Yeah. And it's not stagnant, like you said, that it's the contrast of it. And what I like to play, because literary people, they like do fancy words when they're writing research. So we often play on the idea of like roots and roots, like the journey as a root, okay. And then R-O-U-T-E. And in that sense, you have this compound of oceans is taking part, especially like in recent years, maybe later on we can discuss this as well, about the Pacific Island, how they perceive their oceanic identity. And I remember reading it previously, we're saying that we shouldn't look at the land as if where we anchor ourselves. It's the sea that we anchor ourselves. And then the more that you see the sea, the larger it is. It's not a land-centric kind of perspective, but rather a very mobile, fluid kind of identity. And I think it resonates with many of the new Taiwanese generation as well. Their worldview is not conditioned within the island, but it's like how they connected with other parts of the world. And that part of the world is not just by air, it's also by sea as well.
Yeah, and that really fascinates me because I think there's this historical idea, which for me, that was the beginning of it when I first heard Nikki Alsford talk about the idea of Taiwan as ocean. Then, you know, the first ability to compute that was this historical idea of the expansion of Austronesian people's languages and their cultures like, across the Pacific. And I can kind of get that as the historical thing. And then when you bring it right into the present and you say that even for today's generation of Taiwanese, not necessarily just the indigenous people, just today's Taiwanese people actually are identifying themselves more and more in terms of global connections.
Yes.
I think that's a fascinating twist or flip side to this historical narrative of the ocean being this connector between Taiwan and the rest of the world. That helps something to click for me, I think, that explanation. So thank you for that.
You should say thank Nikki for that. He will be sad that I steal his idea.
Actually, I had the privilege recently of meeting the ambassador for the Republic of the Marshall Islands in Taiwan.
All right.
And listening to her speak, she very naturally in passing referred to their country as a big ocean state. And for me, the first person I ever heard talking about big ocean states was Nikki Alsford. And it clicked. It was like, oh, great. It's a real thing that these people actually refer to themselves and their country as a big ocean state. Do you think that that concept is actually important for the rest of us from the wider world, from other countries, be it Europe, US, other continents, to try to grasp that idea of a big ocean country as opposed to a small island country?
I think it depends on which level you're or which angle you're looking at this. If it's geopolitically speaking, it's a very different kind of approach because even though, say, like UK is also an island. Is it a land-based kind of imagery or is it a more sort of ocean-based sort of country? I would say there's a bit of a mix in the UK. Sure. It's interesting because after all, it has its own colonializations and imperialization. So that kind of ocean state has sort of been changed or transformed in a different way. But I would say that like, for the Marshall Islands or even other different Pacific Islands, for example, previously I was working with Nikki on Kiribati at one point about the climate displacement narrative in general. And these smaller states, the reason why originally they have this discourse of big ocean states is also because they were suppressed in an idea of they are the small island people. And then eventually they are either anthropologists or more politically activists, they stem coming out and then saying that, in fact, it's not quite right to appropriate as a small state has no empowerment exactly because of their resources and their identities are actually linked with the ocean. And if you look at the ocean, it's a very vast one. So I would say that there is a narrative from political side of it to emphasize the contrast of it. And whether do you think that there is a need of other different countries on the Pacific or even in different oceans, say Oceania or the Atlantic, is it necessary for them to create this big ocean state? I guess it depends on which angle they were talking about. If you're from politically, maybe like America wouldn't necessarily emphasize that kind of big ocean state sort of narrative, yeah. because for them, it's not their way of perceiving itself as authority. But I'm pretty sure there are also other parts of it. They're having this sort of oceanic perspective as well, because even when I was looking into, say, the narrative of oceans and whale writing from the literary positions, it's not necessarily exclusive on the Pacific Islands that people have that kind of imagery. It travel across to like the northwest of the Pacific, basically on the side of Canada and America. So it's interesting, like I would say that they have this sort of oceanic link, but whether they perceive themselves and whether they find it useful geopolitically depends, I guess. But in the case of Taiwan, I think there is reiteration, especially since Tsai Ing-wen's regime that she pushes forward about the southbound policy. And today when William Lai taking over more about this Indo-Pacific strategies aligning with, like, for example, like the French are very interesting to Indo-Pacific as well. And this kind of political saying agenda sounds more condescending, but like, I think there is a agenda behind creating that link for Taiwan itself with the Pacific, but not all necessarily negative. Some dimension it could be very, very positive as well, especially when you look back as we're talking about the history of Austronesian cultures and what kind of state that you create, and also what kind of resources that you can share that is more similar in terms of people's ethnicity, cultures, or language. Language or even technology-wise, there seem similar problems they share as well.
Sure. In one sense, maybe there's a political agenda to this focus on Pacific connections. But I guess there could be many political agendas, because we could be talking, in one sense, it's trying to counter a Chinese narrative of Taiwan was always part of China. So it's trying to come against that. On another sense, it could be from an indigenous transitional justice
Yes.
point of view of this is our homeland for thousands of years, and that there's like some overlap and some conflict between these different political agendas. But how would you see, for example, some of the indigenous reconnecting as impacting on Taiwanese society of today? So for an example, we see things like some really good, actually, documentaries from PTS where indigenous Taiwanese musicians have got together with Maori musicians from New Zealand, and there's this musical connection. Or earlier this year, there was a traditional boat from Palau. They used traditional navigation to sail from Palau to Taiwan as a demonstration, I guess, of this oceanic connection. Which, these things are brilliant. They're re-highlighting perhaps something that's always been there, but there's potentially been neglected or at least not focused on. But how would you see this as having some kind of influence on wider Taiwanese society, this reconnecting with the Pacific particularly?
I think for me, that is a genuinely like positive things, basically, because I'm not a person who's sort of romanticized the indigeneity as a very much a sort of, oh, let's go back. It depends on your where you sit in academic discipline. I'm very much contemporary and everything is deconstructed that way. But I also find that it is quite empowering if you find there are similar differences, even in the one particular part of the culture that can be reconnected to the other parts of it. I think people appreciate that. And then people come together, resonate, even though it's a process. There's a fancy word in UK at the moment, in academia, called co-create. That like, if it's a co-creating, reusing the traditional knowledge, reusing the traditional concept, or reusing a traditional even art craft or skills together, and they come together in order to ignite something new, I think is a brilliant thing, because it gives a new dimension of the Taiwanese identity. And earlier, whereas we're talking about the roots and roots, I think this is precisely how the roots can be more open in a sense. And I think, whereas earlier I said that there might be some political agenda to push forward for this oceanic narrative to link with the Pacific Islands, but you are right, from a transitional justice or sort of positions of the indigenous people, I think in large part of them, they are more welcoming into finding this sort of reconnections, because it is true. Like today, it is so easy for us to hop on the plane, even for an indigenous person as well, from here and fly to, I don't know, Marshall Islands or Tuvalu. It's so much easier comparing to they use the traditional method of, say, even the Button Island people in the past from Philippines, when they come to Taiwan and Taiwanese Tao people went back to Philippines. It is interesting to see that they were able to use simply the navigations with technology that inspire from nature, and they are able to do so. And if there are new reconnections of those ties, I think that's rather something that's supposed to be celebrated rather than being repressed.
Oh, that's really good. I guess a final question on this particular book then. How would you condense the message of this book, Reorientating Taiwan? What is the reorientation in a nutshell?
The reorientations, I would say, whatever the books are, be able to bring it to its reader will be, we are thinking from different perspective, either from literary or culture, epistemology, historical, and also more anthropological path in order to revise that kind of connections in these different disciplines. Each chapter has its uniqueness of contributions to different discipline, and a lot of them is also cross-discipline. One of the articles that we have included is also a co-author chapter about studying the ocean and the sea translations in Italian and Catalonian sort of languages from Taiwanese author Wu Mingyi. And so is it in literary studies? Is it in translation studies? Or is it in linguistic studies? I can't. It's three dimension of it. So yeah. It's not as simple to like sort of condense. And then the same thing goes with, say, Scott Simons and also Julian Laporte, their idea of this connections between the ocean. One is through avian connection. The other one is through human and a fish kind of connection. So that's a very, very different take, I would say.
Yeah, it's not a very fair question, but that's a really good. That's a really
very difficult to synthesize. I guess that's why we have multiple chapters, and now we have different parts of it.
Yeah, but I think that's actually really helpful as well, because then it does demonstrate that this is not just a historical or an anthropological thing. It's also a current literary, artistic, and epistemological.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everybody who have problems pronouncing that word.
No. These academic words are difficult, aren't they? So yes, thank you for that. That's really helpful. Mm. Okay. Thinking of you personally now then, with all of these books and all this work, as well as that, you've recently moved from the University of Central Lancashire to SOAS. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't not ask you a little bit about your new role at SOAS. It's exciting to see you bringing new life and energy and your own specific research interests to SOAS. What kind of things have you got on the horizon that you're excited about for what you're bringing to the Center of Taiwan Studies and the students, my 学弟学妹 folks?
First thing first, I keep on saying to this because BU for the last 10 years has done an incredible job. And for me to outlive that kind of expectation is a bit big. But I hope that I will do okay for this role. And what I'm most exciting is because it's a very interesting change. Like in Central Lancashire, I used to teach one module about Taiwan, and the other parts of it is more about Asia Pacific in general. And of course, in different classes, we do bring up Taiwan as part of our example. But to concentrate the teaching and also the curriculum in all events only centered on Taiwan is something that I haven't yet done before. So it's this part is very, very exciting. And plus, once I joined in, I realized, wow, how many events SOAS are running per year. My goodness me.
Yeah.
It was really impressive in a way of how they maintained not just the glamour outlook of SOAS, but also the rigorous part about bringing research, bringing different kind of stimulations, activities, screenings, and also like student participations. That is something for me personally very exciting. And then eventually, if I would be able to like curate some of the events or co-host some of the event, those are the things that I'm most looking forward to. In terms of teaching, something that was getting exciting is that even though I was mainly centered in Taiwan City, sometimes it's quite nice to have also the wider connections. One thing I do appreciate when I first started working in uCloud was I wasn't sitting just as being identified as a Taiwanese studies or Taiwan studies scholars in general, but you were still able to reconnect with people who are wider in the region and wider in your discipline as well. And when I first arrived in SOAS, I thought, oh, then in that case, I'll start from now on, I'll be focusing mainly on Taiwan. Yes, research-wise or teaching-wise, maybe. But when I went to the welcome day and saw the Department of East Asian Studies convening the entire sort of student cohort for MA student, and then later we're going to welcome also the undergraduate student, and you realize there is a large cohort and they do have this sort of ideas thinking you need to bring the region together so that studying a little bit of comparative between Taiwan and Korea will be interesting because both countries were colonized by Japan. But whereas, for example, China's influence on both Korea and Japan's are how in terms of like their kanji or their culture references, they are also very exciting. And then even Taiwan was cited as a reference and they it plays a crucial role in the middle part of it that connecting all these countries together, and which I think that is the most exciting where I can contribute in because I happen to be in the Asia Pacific studies before. But I guess there are also different parts of it. Like Duffy and I both share the interests of our environment and environmental movement, but he's more on the political side. And of course, I really like the part to talk about social movements related to environment. But in the meantime, I also like to explore a bit more about eco-literature or even a bit beyond that kind of horizon on different genre of literature, which I hope that my contribution this part is slightly different from BU's because BU works on more on pop culture and also the nation branding.
Yeah. Oh, exciting. And sounds like a continuation of this bridge building and connections. I guess in some ways, very much like the book we've just been talking about, you'll be making these academic connections across departments, across fields and nations and
I hope so, but I'm also a very new member of staff, so I'm still navigating. It might took me a bit of a time.
Yeah, sure. We've got to give you time to settle in as well.
Yeah. It's a very exciting new page.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll look forward to hopefully welcoming you to Taiwan soon as well. Mm-hmm. As soon as you're settled in there, then we can start attracting you over here. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today, and perhaps we'll have to organize another podcast to talk about one of the other books next time.
But I feel this is very unfair with other my fellow co-editors. They were also the leading part of these projects.
Well, don't feel too bad. We've had Nikki on the podcast before already, so you know, thanks for your time, Jihan. Yeah. And we'll keep the conversations going. So that was Professor Tihan Zhang from SOAS talking about her new book, Reorientating Taiwan, which was co-authored with Professor Nikki Alsford, who you can also hear if you skip back to one of our previous podcast episodes. Thanks very much for listening. Don't forget that if you're interested, you can sign up for our International Taiwan Study Centre newsletter from NTNU here. Until next time, goodbye, folks.